Okay, so tonight we're going to conclude our discussion of social contract and natural law, as we had been discussing, by sort of taking what has been predominantly a discussion rooted in Western sources, certainly with regard to social contract. It's primarily not a topic that gets much discussion in the Jewish sources, in part because we don't necessarily have the autonomous political structure in order to really ask these questions and play these kinds of things out. We did note that there are some Jewish sources with regard to social contract, in particular a classic debate that we saw as to the foundation for the principle that mandates observing the law of the land. Dina d'malchuta dina is a principle that appears no less than 6 times in the Gemara in the name of Shmuel. Amar Shmuel, dina d'malchuta dina, again and again and again. There is a range of positions among the medieval commentators, the Rishonim, as to the basis for that principle, but we did see that there's a classic position of the Rashbam, grandson of Rashi, who maintains that, in essence, the basis for dina d'malchuta dina is social contract, that all the members of the kingdom willingly accept upon themselves, voluntarily accept, to observe the laws of the land, and therefore we are all brought in as members, as participants in this social contract. So we did see that there is some context, although there again, it's not a thesis that justifies or basis, provides a philosophical foundation for the right of Jewish autonomy for the Jewish government, rather for our obligation to observe the law of the land. I would add that with regard to social contract, there are echoes of that idea in more focused or specific kinds of contexts. Just today I was discussing with one of my classes an interesting example of this with regard to the obligation of charity, of tzedakah. It's actually in the Tikva class just today. And the question arose that there seems to be a contradiction or a question of sort with regard to tzedakah. So I'll go a little bit of an aside just to elaborate or explain where this social contract idea comes in with regard to tzedakah. So there's a little bit of a contradiction that arises in this sugya. There's a question that comes up in general whether or not we coerce someone to observe mitzvot. That's a general question, and it's a question that arises with regard to tzedakah. In fact, there's a Gemara Masechet Bava Batra and Daf Chedem Abed which reports that the rabbis at a particular time coerce Rav Natan, to give tzedakah. So this notion that we do coerce with regard to tzedakah, and that even if someone refuses to open up their wallets, their pocketbooks, and to write that check, right, Beit Din will actually require it in certain circumstances in which the community mandates a certain kind of charitable donation. So there's a question that arises because this seems to contravene a basic principle that arises, because we know that the Gemara in Chulin and Daf Kuf Yud teaches us that any mitzvah with regard to which the reward appears explicitly in the Torah. So such a mitzvah, for whatever reason, the logic is sort of aside for our purposes, but the bottom line is the Gemara says that if the reward appears explicitly in the Torah, Beit Din does not coerce such a mitzvah. Which is an interesting idea. Again, the reasoning, let's leave that aside for a moment. But we know that in Parshat Re'eh, in the Torah, we actually find explicitly that the Torah promises that if a person is generous with regard to tzedakah, if a person gives tzedakah, so there is a blessing, that a person will be successful, the chol ma'aseh yadecha, that the Torah guarantees financial success, general success, whatever exactly that means. But the bottom line is the Torah seems to promise a reward with regard to charity. So the question arises, wait a second, here you have the reward is written right there, what we call matan schar, that the reward is written right there next to it. And yet at the same time, the Gemara says that the Beit Din did coerce Rav Natan to give tzedakah. So Tosfot and many of the medieval commentators, many of the Rishonim, struggle to understand how is it that the fact that Rav Natan was coerced to give tzedakah does not contradict the principle in the Gemara and Chulin that wherever the reward is written there, that there's no coercion that's permitted. And there's a range of answers offered by the Rishonim. Tosfot alone offers 4. There's an additional answer that we were really interested in, that context, which is the Ritva, and the Ritva postulates that actually the reasoning is not because of the positive obligation, but rather tzedakah is actually an obligation that is inherent to my property. In other words, there is a lien on my property from the poor people who have a right to my money, which is a really powerful notion. In other words, not just an obligation for me, but to some degree, my ownership has inherent limitations. And it's almost sort of a philosophical point here about the Torah's approach to ownership, and that was sort of the context for that conversation. One of the other answers that's offered, and this is the one that's relevant for us, Tosfot suggests that actually the reason that we coerce in this case is not because of the obligation, but rather because all the members of the community have willingly accepted upon themselves certain tzedakah obligations. So the Torah says what it says, and that would not be sufficient for Beit Din to force me to do so. But once the people all accept upon themselves willingly, i.e., sort of a narrow case of a quasi-social contract, right, a communal commitment to disperse tzedakah, so that's why Beit Din is allowed to require me to do so, because we've all accepted that obligation independent of the law of the Torah. So that would be another example of social contract. And you find other cases where the fact that the community accepts something upon themselves can become binding. So we do find examples of social contract, even though it's not the full-throated kind of larger philosophical discussions, and even though it doesn't appear in a fully autonomous context. But nevertheless, we do find that notion in halakha. What I want to do today, though, is to ask ourselves the question, sort of, is there a unique Jewish contribution to this discussion? Is there an additional angle that, if you take a look at Torah generally in the Jewish tradition, sort of that emerges organically from that and has something to contribute to the larger conversation? And essentially, Rabbi Sachs's argument in one of his recent books, one of my favorites, entitled The Home We Build Together, his answer is absolutely yes. And he brings this Jewish philosophy or a series of Jewish principles that he derives from the Torah and other sources as well. He brings them to bear on a social concern that is become increasingly fraught with anxiety in Western Europe in particular, which is the challenge of multiculturalism. Challenge of multiculturalism, essentially what you have is mass immigration into major cities of Western Europe. And the question becomes, I think, not exclusively, but most well-known, and just quantity-wise, I think, by far the largest, certainly, is Muslim immigration in particular. And you have entire sections of cities such as London and Paris, and so on and so forth, that have separate populations that really live, in many ways, completely detached lives from that of those who have lived in these major cities for many generations. And there are all sorts of challenges and frankly breakdowns in communication and the relationships between these communities, and we're seeing this play out today, and it's very frightening as to what the implications are. And for many years, many of the politicians, sort of the dominant trend in Western European political thought, had been this notion of multiculturalism, which is basically this idea that if we respect and we tolerate and we create space for different cultures, for multiculturalism, right? So then essentially what we'll do is we'll enable those separate cultures to live freely, comfortably, and feel tolerated, even welcomed and embraced in our larger society. There is a sense, there's been an increasing sense over the last decade or two, and it's intensifying pretty much every day, in particular now in light of everything that's gone on. There certainly is a very strong counter-reaction from the right, and from the political right, which essentially argues that this is a failed policy. And what we actually need to do is to call a spade and to say that these are individuals whose philosophies are completely at odds with ours, and we need to take a hard line, and we need to essentially recapture the spirit, the true spirit of our country, right, of Western Europe in general, of whether it be Great Britain or especially acutely in France, and what it means to be a Parisian, and so on and so forth. And so you sort of have these two warring political factions, but there's certainly the sense that multiculturalism is broken down. And The Home We Build Together is Rabbi Sachs's sort of foray into this discussion, and this is his grounded, both philosophically as well as Jewishly, proposal for a new paradigm, a new political paradigm, and it's called The Home We Build Together. And it's part of this prescription trying to address the social ills, the maladies and challenges of Western Europe at this time. Much of what he addresses is this notion of social contract, and really going beyond the notion of social contract. And sort of builds his argument in a number of steps, and we'll begin to see, especially a little bit toward the end, the kinds of prescription that he's offering in terms of resolving some of these issues. So I'm not going to begin from the beginning of this book. I'm actually going to begin sort of in medias res in terms of how I structure the argument, just because I think it helps organically in terms of the social contract piece from that angle. So look at it from that angle, but you'll see, especially as we go along, and especially toward the end, how this is also a prescription to try to address some of the challenges that Western society, Western civilization, generally, and in particular Western Europe, is facing at this moment in time. So his first question is, or sort of first lays out the social contract tradition in much the way that we've done in previous classes, and he quotes from Locke, he quotes from Rousseau, and so on and so forth, as we've been discussing as we've gone along. And he says, what does the Torah have to say about this? So the first thing that he points out is that although we generally do not necessarily associate social contract with Jewish thought, the truth is that there is, perhaps, or arguably, such a notion, not only in some of the sources that we've mentioned, but even grounded in the biblical sources. In particular, he discusses the classic question, the classic really apparent contradiction as to whether or not there's an obligation to appoint a king. Two classic political texts with regard to monarchy. You have on one hand Sefer Shoftim, where the Torah teaches us that in Perek Yud Zayin, beginning in Pasuk Yud Dalet, Ki Tevel Haaretz Asher Hashem Elokechem Noten Lach, V'Yirishah V'Yashav Tevel V'Yamarta, and you shall say, Asima Alai Melech Kecha Goyim Asher Svivotai. So the Torah says that what's the response in Pasuk Tevav? Som Tasim Alecha Melech Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokechem Bo, Nikar and so on and so forth, right? And then the Torah adds a certain laws, certain limitations to this seeming obligation, right, or recommendation at minimum to appoint a king. And the Torah says, at least in context when the Jews ask for it, right? However, right, not too many horses, shouldn't return the Jews to Egypt, he shouldn't marry too many women, right? And so on and so forth. He writes the Torah, he keeps it close with him, with the goal of that of his continuing to study his entire life, so that his he remains anchored in our traditions, right, and so on and so forth, right? The sense of humility of this king. Certainly, this is this is a benevolent monarchy, if there ever was one, right? Pasuk Chaf, Livel Tirum Levavo Me'achav, the importance of modesty, of humility, right? The famous statement of Lord Acton, that absolute power corrupts absolutely, and the Torah is well aware of that, that danger, and so there's a sense of the importance of his continuing to feel one of the people, and to continue to observe the commandments all of his days. That's one passage with regards to monarchy. And then we come to the famed story in Sefer Shmuel, and Shmuel Aleph Perek Chet, beginning from the opening of the chapter. And here we find that when Shmuel becomes old, the question is, who will become the next leader of the Jewish people? If it turns to the next page, so what happens is, Pasuk Dalev, Yekabtsu Kol Zevei Yisrael, Vayavoo Shmuel Haramata. So all the Jewish people, all the elders gather, and they come to Shmuel, and they say, you are old, right? Unfortunately, your children have not taken after your path. They have not followed your direction, right? Ata sima lanu melech. Right now, appoint for us the king, to judge us like all the other nations. And instead of saying, okay, the Torah says som tasim alecha melech. So classically, vayirah devar. We know vayirah devar b'nei Shmuel. Right? This is evil. It's negative in the eyes of Shmuel. Kasher amru tina lanu melech l'shavtenu. So he turns to Hashem, and Hashem says, well, don't worry. You should listen to them. No worries. Don't take this personally. It's not about you. I got this one. It's about me. Right? And this is no different from everything that they've been doing in their relationship with me from when I took them out of Egypt, right? These ingrates. They abandoned me. They worshipped other gods. They're just doing more of the same to you. It's really no different, and so on and so forth. And then he actually reviews the laws of the king, right? When Shmuel actually repeats to them, right, and says that it's going to be okay. He says it's going to be okay, but there are rules, right? Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomer Zeyem Mishpat Hamelach Asher Yimlo Chalichem. You should just know, Et Bneichem Yikach V'Sam Lo B'Merkav Tov V'Farashav Rasu Lifnei Merkav Tov. Right? He can take your children, right? V'Et Bnoteichem Yikach, right? In Pasuk Yigimah, take your daughters, V'Et Sadeoteichem V'Et Karmichem and Zeiteichem Atovim Yikach V'Natan La'Avadav, and so on and so forth, right? And so you should know that there are certain rules that apply, right? You want a king, that's fine, but appointing a king means that there are certain sacrifices, there are certain trade-offs, and quite frankly, this monarch might be a very powerful monarch, right? And he might be able to implement all sorts of laws that are undesirable to you. So you know, you're able to go ahead with this. At the end, if this is what you want, that's fine by me. But you should just know it comes at a significant cost. And they say, we're going to do it anyway, this is what we want, and ultimately God does this. So this is the classic story, and the question is sort of how do we reconcile these two, and there's a long literature about that. There's a wide range of opinions as to whether or not there is in fact an obligation. It already begins in the Gemara. The Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Aleph has a variety of views on this. It spawned a whole literature with views ranging from yes, there is an obligation, to there's permissibility, to it's something that you're really not supposed to do, to the Torah may seem like it's suggesting monarchy in particular, but really it's actually suggesting something that follows the general structure of monarchy, and actually, for example, meaning democracy is acceptable or even preferred. You have interesting examples of commentaries whose personal life story, whose sort of autobiographical experience seems to weigh on them as they consider some of the dangers of monarchy in particular. So you have someone like Abarbanel, who originally served as the vizier to Ferdinand and Isabella until 1492, and things went south from there, and he ultimately was perhaps chose, but ultimately was exiled together with his people, and Granada was no longer there for him. And so he writes about some of the limitations and the dangers of a monarchy, and it's hard to imagine that that's just a pure coincidence, although he doesn't explicitly say this was my experience or draw, but he certainly talks about some of the contemporary models that were around during his time. The Nitziv takes the opportunity to decry what seems to be something along the lines of Tsarist Russia. In other words, he doesn't call it by that name, for some obvious reasons. So she got funding from the Russian government, for example, and he wanted to ensure safety. But it's difficult to mistake that, for example, his description in other contexts, in particular of Migdal Bavel, of the sin of Migdal Bavel, he understands, he basically is describing the sin of Migdal Bavel as having created a totalitarian state. It's almost unmistakable. And although he doesn't explicitly refer to it, it's hard to see it as this. So there's a huge literature on this topic. It's worth certainly a fuller discussion in its own right. But Rabbi Sachs's point is, he suggests whether this actually may sound a little bit more Hobbesian than Lockean. In other words, this may say it sound more like a Leviathan than sort of a more benevolent description of what the king might be able to do. But essentially, in other words, Sachs suggests this is sort of a form of social contract in the sense that it's fine. If you want to insist on this, maybe you're doing the wrong thing. That could be. But if this is something that you insist upon, that's fine. But you should just know that part of what it means to have a king is to give up certain rights. That's one of the key points in a social contract. You know, the community chooses to give up certain rights. You want to have a king. Here's what it means to have a king. Let me describe for you what it means to have a king if you want someone who will actually govern in this state. Now, of course, maybe there could have been modifications as to exactly what he was able to do, and maybe there's a little bit of scare factor that's taking place here. Right, that certainly seems to be part of it. There's no question. Isaac suggests that the notion of social contract, even if it's not necessarily a benevolent kind of context, does make some sort of, arguably, might be making an appearance here in the story, and that can begin to help us understand part of what's really going on in all of this. And that's sort of his first point. But then what he says is that that's not necessarily Judaism's unique contribution. And essentially what he argues is that social contract on its own falls short. All right, this social contract, as we see here in Sefer Shmuel, certainly doesn't seem like it's getting much of good publicity. It's not exactly a clarion call toward a social contract model. Moreover, he suggests and he points out that there is a larger contractual agreement, essentially, that we find in the Torah, which is not inherently political, but his argument is essentially that is exactly the point. And it's what he calls not political, but rather a civil agreement, and in particular, he loves to use the term a covenantal one. Right, so there's social contract, but then there is what he calls covenantal politics. And in particular, he points to none other than the agreement of Matan Torah, of the Revelation, the Decalogue. And essentially, what you have there, and there is, he doesn't go into all of this, although he goes into some of it, some of the more recent literature, last number of decades already, on Aseret HaDibrot, comparing it in particular to ancient Near Eastern agreements, is that you find a lot of striking parallels between what the Torah lays out in the Aseret HaDibrot and many of the ancient agreements that you find between a variety of ancient Near Eastern kings and their vassals. Very, very similar kind of thing. A structure very much the same. In the Hittite law codes, you find this. In Hammurabi, there may be a little bit of this, but in particular, among the Hittite and other law codes, what you find is essentially a king will conquer a vassal state, and then we'll do as follows. We'll write a document, and the document will be signed by both sides. And there will be sort of this contractual arrangement or agreement of terms. And what the king will lay out is sort of begin with the prologue, and the prologue outlines the historical context to this agreement. And then there is actually a description of the responsibilities from each side. So that the vassal state will provide the following services, will pay the following taxes, will obey the following laws, and so on and so forth. And the king, in return, will ensure the protection of the vassals, the good treatment, and a certain amount of liberty, freedom, etc. So you find this idea. What the Torah does is it takes that model. And if you're interested in more, there's a wonderful book by Professor Joshua Berman, who's at Bar Ilan, I believe. He's a frum guy and a very well Bible professor. One of his recent works is entitled Created Equal. Created Equal. And essentially what he argues is that what the Torah is doing, politics in a number of different areas, is essentially taking many of the ancient Near Eastern models that you find out there at the time, and his point is that they become more egalitarian. So in other words, for example, instead of having the king and the vassal, and this is one of his key arguments, instead what you have is a relationship that's much more of equals. There still is not a fully equal relationship that's taking place here, but there's much more dignity, there's much more of a sense of covenant or sort of reciprocity here than what happens when I just conquer you and that's it. So in other words, it's not just that you owe me tribute and that's it. We actually have a meaningful relationship. And that could exist not only between a human king, flesh and blood, but actually between a humans and God himself. And so the kinds of relationship that you have are much more, if not fully equal, there's much more of a sense of esteem. And so much of those ancient Near Eastern agreements, contracts, were essentially about hierarchies and the role of the priests, which was so accented and so dramatically different from the role of everyone else in society, and so on and so forth, and the rights of the king as opposed to the rights of the vassals, such a hierarchical society. And what the Torah is really doing is it's taking that model, but it sort of turns it on its head, or at least it weakens it considerably by moving toward a breaking down of many of these kinds of hierarchies in society. It's a fascinating kind of study and highly recommended, and I don't know if I think Rabbi Sachs may have published his book beforehand, and I remember if he refers to it explicitly in The Home We Build Together, but there's a lot of sort of intersection between them. And so Rabbi Sachs essentially argues is that one of the fundamental mistakes that we find in society nowadays is, this is sort of echoes with some conservative kinds of arguments that you hear now in America, but it's a little bit different because it's being mentioned, it's being suggested in Western European context, is sort of this notion of an outsourcing of civil society to political society. And essentially what Rabbi Sachs argues is, what the Torah's argument is sure, maybe there needs to be a social contract, but if all you have is a social contract, if all you've thought about is the role of political society and how you structure that, you've made a terrible mistake. And what the Torah is recommending here is that alongside a political structure, whatever exactly that political structure may be, there needs to be a parallel and, quite frankly, even more influential civil society instead of civil agreements. And here you can call them social contracts. But see, here it fundamentally differs from social contract. The social contract, as we talk about in the liberal tradition, is essentially about sort of not stepping on each other's toes, right? It's about respecting your rights, right? That's right. that's a large part, it's not all, but it's a large part of what social contract is all about, certainly in a Lockean kind of vein, right, or in other modern thinkers as well, that's very much what we're talking about. So I sacrifice some of my individual rights in order that as a whole, in all of society, as many of us will be able to sustain and to protect as many of our own individual rights as we possibly can. And that's important, and government has a role there. But if that's all we have in society, or if that's the thrust of society, then we're going to end up deeply impoverished. And what we need instead is a civil society in which we not only essentially say we're not going to interfere with one another, but a civil society which embraces certain common core values, even as it respects a certain degree of diversity. And that's sort of his core thesis, and this is his fundamental critique of multiculturalism. If all we have to prescribe for society is say, you do your thing, and we'll do our thing, so the problem is that we're never going to have an integrated society in a meaningful sense. On the other hand, if all we say is this is a melting pot, and what a melting pot means is we are an X society, we are a waspy society, we're this kind of society, we're that kind of society, and you have to be like us, right, or else, right, as opposed to right, the salad bowl, in which case, in which everything is separate, the melting pot, but it's a melting pot means you have to, right, become like a man, and that's very much what American society was, so then you're going to have an equal and opposite problem, right, because then you're going to have the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim in Israel, right, as we've seen, and that doesn't work either. If you say, this is an Ashkenazi, kibbutznik, labor society, right, and you guys are inferior, essentially, unless you assimilate into us, that's not going to work either. And so Rabbi Sacks suggests, on the basis of this notion of an expansive civil society and this notion of the covenant, is that what the covenant is it's built together. It's built as a group, it's built as a unit, and that's exactly what a covenant is all about. And so God redeems the Jews from Egypt, but instead of just imposing everything upon them, there is a sense in which the Jews are a more, now it's not perfect here, because the Jews don't necessarily give input into what Masoret HaDibro look like, etc. So there's a little bit of a limitation there. But as much as possible, the Jews are sort of respected as part of this process, and they're brought into it. And so Rabbi Sacks' prescription, essentially, for society, therefore becomes something along the following lines. What we need to do is to not only focus on political society, but to rebuild civic society. What does civic society look like? Civic society is essentially what he describes as the home we build together. It's a neutral space in which we can, on the one hand, respect fundamental differences between different societies, and yet there is space in the middle around points of common interest and common value in which we build something together. And he describes this very movingly, and he quotes de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville's famed Democracy in America, who comes, visits from France in the 1830s, has an incredibly insightful and moving description of so many of the institutions in America, which you read it now, 180 years later, and it's remarkable because it's the same thing. There are obviously differences, and there are some things that have been lost, but there are certain sort of kernels of that, and you recognize them and say, oh my gosh, that's us. Like, you're looking in a mirror. It's an amazing thing. Incredibly insightful. And in particular, one of the things that de Tocqueville describes is things like social associations and how important those were in American society and that those were lacking where he was coming from. So it's meeting houses, it's churches, and how central houses of worship were for the community. It's community centers. It's all these kinds of context, these town halls that they used to hold in these different kinds of places, different kinds of civil societies that have nothing to do with the political structures of society around which there's a sense of building community. And this is what he sort of extracts from this, and this is sort of his recommendation.
Can I just clarify something? Yeah. So it sounds like the social contract is really about protecting individual rights, and that even though Rabbi Sacks would agree that's important, it's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that the covenant sort of protects the values of the community.
That's right.
But I guess I just wonder if it's more than that, if it's also that not just values of the community, but that we are kind of interconnected as a community.
Absolutely. 100%.
That's
a huge piece of it. In other words, yes, this intersects beautifully with research on happiness and et cetera, that having social networks that are support systems and that around which we come together itself lends itself to a happier, higher functioning set. Is that what you're
saying? That we affect each other, that we are interconnected in a way, right? That we're not really just complete individuals.
Mm-hmm.
The social contract sort of
right.
supports individual autonomy, but yet we're not, it seems mm-hmm. like the covenant sort of implies, but we're not just complete individuals. We work and function as a society, as a group.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to note that. Okay.
Yeah. Awesome. No, 100%. Yeah. And again, the process and then the psychological insight is also that when we build something together, it creates community.
Right.
In other words, instead of starting, and this is I think a really interesting insight, and I will say that it's one that I found to be incredibly helpful in all sorts of ways. In other words, there are all sorts of times we're all connected to different kinds of institutions or organizations. Families are structured like this, all different kinds of community. Inherent to the notion of community is that there are going to be differences of opinion, there are going to be different orientations. It's just there's certain things that are systemic. Sometimes it's more pronounced than in other cases. Sometimes there isn't as much as sometimes more history, whatever it may be, but those are the building blocks of any community. And sometimes what happens is that those differences get accented, and sometimes somehow we're able to acknowledge those differences and grant them and yet move forward. And the question is, what distinguishes those two kinds of scenarios? And one of the things that I've found is that in order to accomplish anything, there needs to be trust. And one of the ways to build trust is to not start by or to only focus on that which divides, but when you go through the process of building something together in a healthy way that everyone is bought into, that really helps to make some of the differences of opinion easier to talk about. It doesn't make them go away. It never makes them go away. But when there's a baseline of having done something together, there's a shared experience that highlights shared values and partnership and models this notion, and we actually experience that notion of building something together, that allows us to then have the conversations about areas that are more difficult in healthier kinds of ways sometimes. And I think that's part of his suggestion.
And that's the significance of a covenant. Like, you can't just have the social contract without it.
Right. Because otherwise society will fray.
Right.
And that's exactly what he's observing about multiculturalism. Now, what's fascinating, so a couple of additional things. Number one, I'm going to go a little bit out of order here, but just to point you some of the text that you have here. He elaborates much of this in a smaller form, if you want to see, in an essay. You can look at source number 9 here on the sheet on page 7. Won't read it now, but one of his essays in his Covenant and Conversation, this is published some 11 years back, on Parsha Truma, is, and this is not only his observation, many of them at this point, but sort of the notion of the home that we build together, and in particular, Rabbi Lam also has a drasha about this that works nicely in tandem with this piece, essentially the difference between the first Beit HaMikdash and the construction of the Mishkan. The difference between them. That whereas Shlomo HaMelech sort of outsourced the construction of the first Beit HaMikdash to Melech Tzur up in modern-day Lebanon, and essentially had his people, his craftsmen, come down. They provided materials, they sent them down the Mediterranean, and they essentially constructed this grandiose building, and that was wonderful, and that may have been necessary for the time. The experience of building something together was lacking there, maybe by necessity, but it didn't happen the same way as opposed to the Mishkan, where you really have this sense that everyone is, we're not outsourcing it, and we're actually all in it together. And the Nedivot Lev that the people demonstrated through that process was an extremely powerful one. It was specifically not a sort of a political decision or structure. It was something, there was an Nedivot Lev. People just decided, there was a request that was made, and people said, you know what, we want in, we're going to do this together. And there was really something about that process that really was unifying, and that's society, it's not the state. And those are two different things. It's sort of, that's a voluntary kind of community in a sense. That's the kind of thing that that we're talking about here. And also it goes to leadership, because he points out in the second paragraph that one of the great challenges of leadership is to allow people to step in. And if I do too much on my own and I don't allow for buy-in and people to have portals of entry into that community and to really help to build whatever it is, even if I have the talents and the ability and the capacity, to maybe even do it better on my own. But ultimately, in terms of the long-term health of the community, obviously within limitations, it's important for everyone to have that opportunity, and it creates a really healthy kind of community. So he elaborates it here, but in shorter form, so if you'd like it, it's there. Now, he asks himself further, he says, this is very nice for the original covenant, and when there's sort of a moment in time when we all stand at the foot of the mountain, coming back to where we were, page 3, right, and we all stand at the foot of the mountain, and we all assent to this covenant. That's a wonderful thing, and that's extremely important. And he says, the question is, how do we ensure the perpetuation of that covenant? Right? This is something that's not meant to last for a year, for a decade, for a generation. This is meant to be the lifeblood of a people, of a community, essentially forever, for an extremely long period of time, right? For the long term. Now, one moment that is now thousands and thousands and thousands of years behind us, how can that possibly sustain us? It can't on its own. That's not possible. So just that single moment of commitment, of buy-in, we're going to build something, right, that obviously needs to somehow be renewed. All right, it needs to be renewed, but it's and that will modify and it will change, but it also has to go back to sort of the core, right? This notion of, well, we're going to just so build something new every generation. That's very nice for building a new community, but if our goal is to sustain this community on the basis of its core values, granted that of course there are things that change in every generation, but if it's sort of the same essential covenant and it is going to continue and not just become something different or take on a new quote-unquote building project moving forward, right? How do we ensure the perpetuity of that original covenant? And what he suggests is the Torah gives us an incredible blueprint by building in this notion of the renewal of the covenant into the lifeblood of our people. So it's not enough to have a covenant. It's necessary to ritualize, to build in that renewed commitment. And he traces this, and I'll add some sources that if I remember, he does not necessarily include all of these, but this becomes very much his reading of a number of key rituals. So, for example, that of Hakel. Right, what happens in Hakel? So, if you take a look at source 4, essentially everyone joins together every 7 years. Moshe Rabbeinu writes the Torah. He commands them. Then pasuk yad vayitzav Moshe otam lemor mikedeshav shanim b'moed shana yitav chag asuko. Right. So it's right the end of the Shemitah year, essentially. So this comes in Sukkot. Right. Bevochal Yisrael they wrote me Hashem l'kachal b'mkor shirchar tekrat haTorah zot negan kol Yisrael b'aznayim. Everyone needs to be present. Hakel otam gather the people. Anashim v'anashim v'atav the gerchashir b'shiracha. They're all going to hear, right? And even those who were not here originally, right? Or even those who were too young, they're also going to learn, right? What it means, and they're going to be able to observe this commandment. And in fact, if you take a look at source number 4, again, I don't believe Rabbi Sachs mentions this particular source, but Rav Soloveitchik highlighted this, and others as well. That's the Rambam in Hilchot Chagiga, Paragimel Halacha Vav, on page 4 now. So he essentially describes the experience of Hakel as comparable, or sort of really a reenactment of the events of Har Sinai. V'girim shinam akirim chayavim la'achim li'bam u'lakshiv oznam lishmoa. That converts who don't have any idea, they don't really understand, they haven't yet learned the language in order to properly understand that which is being conveyed, but they are obligated to prepare themselves for this awesome experience that he describes, ki yom shenitna bo b'Sinai. Literally, as the day that it was given at Sinai. And the language that we're using here, Ema, Yira, Gila, Bir, Ada, these are the descriptors of that lightning and sound show, right? That lightning sound show that we experience at Har Sinai. And it's not an intellectual experience so much as it is an emotional one. This is an emotional reconnection, reenactment. And we know about reenactments, right? We have military reenactments, and here we have a covenantal reenactment. And that's really ultimately what Hakel is, and that's really the idea or that's a paradigmatic example of where Jewish ritual builds in a nationwide, right, a people-wide recommitment, a reliving of our national narrative of that covenant. One can make the argument that that is how we understand the Seder. that the Seder night, right, is a reenactment of Yetziat Mitzrayim. That's why the Rambam famously writes in Perek Zayin, Halachot Vav and Zayin of the Chot Chametz Matzah, that it's not enough to see oneself as if I've gone out, but we actually have to act it out. Very famously, the Rambam says the basis for Sephardic practice is throwing the matzahs over the shoulder and walking around the table, and many of these practices, that Bechol Dor V'Dor, Chayav Adam, Liharot Etzatzmo, you don't just imagine, you actually get up and you do it. You read the Torah in front of all the people. You act out the events of Yetziat Mitzrayim as if we're reliving it right now. Because what it does is it ritualizes, in this case for a family, which is equally as important, the nuclear family context for this reenactment or this renewal, as it is for the entire nation, and this is on an annual basis, and this goes back to Yetziat Mitzrayim as opposed to Matan Torah, for the key moments of our, right, those formative moments for us as a people, that those are relived as well, and that's really how the Rambam understands the essence of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. He then has a fascinating insight. What he suggests is that this is in fact not just a Jewish practice, and there are other examples in the Jewish tradition, but he suggests, and it's very interesting because he seems to prefer America to Western Europe in this regard, and he's pretty open, direct about this despite his context and his own personal history and ministry. But he suggests that this is essentially what happens in an American context as well. And he points in particular to the president's inaugural address. And he notes, first of all, one interesting difference. He says that if you look at if you look in Great Britain and compare it to American inaugural speeches, there's one key difference. And it's really just captured in a three-letter word, which is God. God. He says that God doesn't appear prominently in those presentations. And it's almost mandatory for a president, even if the president's not particularly religious, it's understood that God plays that role. And not just God needs to be a central part, but really our larger narrative, right? Our national narrative. And pretty much every single inaugural address, there are certain necessary elements. The speechwriter will consult with the president and ensure that those are in there. And it's always going back to our core values, to what animated us as a people, to what caused us to create this great union and the way that God led us to do so, right? And going back to our original covenant as a people, our covenant with God, our covenant with one another, the founding narrative, the founding principles of us as a people. And this is not just an opportunity for the president to, it's not like a State of the Union or something like that. In other words, this is not about staking, right? This is not about political posturing, although it's that as well. It's not about political policies, it's that as well. But at its core, the most important function, which you don't find at other presidential presentations, lectures, is really this notion of the renewal of the covenant. So we don't think about it that way, but every 4 years we're reminded by the elected standing president as to what those are. And he gives some classic examples. So JFK did this brilliantly. So JFK is dealing with, on the one hand, a particular moment in time, and there's all the tension around the Cold War and our relationship with the USSR. It's a very difficult moment for us in that regard. And so on the one hand, he talks about the differences between our world and the world earlier, but he says right in the bottom here, "For I have sworn before you and the Almighty God the same solemn oath our forebears prescribed nearly a century and three quarters ago." And he says there are nuclear weapons. It's a different kind of world. The dangers and the issues are different, that for sure. But at the same time, we go back and we remember. We dare not, first full paragraph on the next page. We dare not forget today that we are heirs of that first revolution. It's the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears thought, those are the same ones, right? And they come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. And so on and so forth. And it's a very famous presentation, right? And of course he said, "My fellow citizens of the world, that's not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man," right? Right? That's not what your country can do for you, that's what you can do for your country. Right? It's all there. But his point is that that's really what this is about. So America has this. He says, where did America get it from? Well, we got it from the Bible. This is biblical politics at its best. And this is the notion of the covenant. And that even political society acknowledges the existence of a larger narrative and this idea of civil society, right? And that's really a call to action in that regard. I would add just an interesting anecdote that I once heard about. At Yeshiva University, every 4 years there is what they call a Chag HaSmicha, which is sort of the last 4 years that those who have received rabbinic ordination are celebrated, and they come, and it's a big thing. And now they're like upwards of 200 people, 50, they're graduating 50 people a year, and it's a lovely occasion. So one time Rav Soloveitchik was the keynote speaker, or spoke at one of the Chag HaSmicha programs. He said, "I don't understand what this is." He says, "I know what a graduation is. Graduation happens every year." He says, "What is this? This is like a it's, right? It's you're finished for 3.5 years. You're done, right? It's not like you're off, like you moved to, I don't know, you took a pulpit in Melbourne, for God's sake. It's not a graduation. You've been there for 3.5 years. What exactly is the purpose of this? Is it just because we don't have the resources to run this every year, which is probably true? It's too big a pain. Okay, that's all true. Apparently the Rav said, Julius Berman, who is very close with the Rav, described this, and he said that the Rav said no, that's not what the Chag HaSmicha is all about. He said it's a celebration of the flowering of Torah in the United States of America, in our community. And that's really what it is. It's not a graduation. If we're graduation, it would be an annual event. It's a celebration of our core values. It's an opportunity for us to go back to the core principles of what this institution is, to restate them, to celebrate them, and to recommit ourselves to them. And to me, that's really very much, again, it's not every year necessarily. It's every 7 years in the case of Hakel, it's every 4 years, and that's not a presidential address, but it is a moment every 4 years, right, where an institution has the opportunity to say that it's about something larger than just itself, and to restate what it really is about, and to galvanize, and to remind all of ourselves, and to inspire. And again, it's not an intellectual exercise, but it's really experiential. And the last piece that I put here is something that you certainly know well and familiar with, which is this classic article from the New York Times, The Stories That Bind Us. You're familiar with this, and we've discussed this. But I put this in this context. This is a classic piece from March 15th, 2013. To me, it's classic even though it's less than 2 years old. But really, this notion that when we have a narrative, in this case a family narrative, that allows us to really overcome all sorts of adversity. But to me, this is very much the same idea. To the extent that we're grounded, whether as an individual, as a family member, as a people, as a nation, as a religious group, whatever it may be, grounded in a powerful, compelling narrative that I really feel a part of and I really feel connected to, and there are opportunities for me to reconnect with it over the course of my life. So when that happens, I'm better able to overcome adversity. I have a sense of mission. I have a sense of calling. I have a sense that really gives me direction in terms of who I am and what it is that I want to accomplish. And that renewal of that covenant and those commitments really allows me to be successful in all sorts of ways across really the span of my life. So that's really this idea. And I think that this is a really beautiful rounding out of our study. And Rabbi Sacks's argument is that social contrast is truly important, but it's not enough. And I think that this idea, not just the covenant, but the renewal and the ritualizing, the building it in, and the consequences of that, and the ways that we need to be mindful of how we do that as individuals, for ourselves, as institutions, as members of families, leaders of families. I think there's a lot here, and there's really a lot to think about. To me, it's been, and again, this notion of building something together as a way of creating institutions, creating communities, is a really powerful notion that I think is lots of really practical application as well, and I think offers a lot of food for that. So that's just to round out the social contract or to really complement it. As we move forward, the next discussion is going to be about a different topic altogether, individual and community. So the tension, the relationship between the two, it touches on some of the things here as well, and that's what we'll pick up with, God willing, for our next mini-series as we move on. Thank you.